From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven when you're down, when you're strange.
On today's Fresh Air, Life with the Doors, we talk with the band's keyboard player, Ray Manzarek. He's written a new memoir called Light My Fire about the band, its lead singer, Jim Morrison, and the psychedelic era the Doors were part of. Manzarek will join us at the piano and play us the stories behind his most famous solos. Also, the classic adventure stories of Horatio Hornblower are being republished. Book critic Maureen Corrigan tells us why she's become a new convert. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Western entertainer Roy Rogers has died. His spokesman says Rogers died from congestive heart failure at home in Apple Valley, California. Rogers was well known for his films and songwriting. He starred in 87 pictures and was the leading Western star at the box office between 1943 and 1954. During a 1992 interview with NPR, Rogers discussed his thinking on songwriting.
It's got a pretty tune, it's got a good message, well, it's naturally it has a better chance to survive or become something. But you never know, because there's a lot of those records that are beautiful records to me, and the average public might not hit a bunch of them, you know what I mean?
Roy Rogers was 86 years old. Jury selection opens today in Florida for the first major tobacco trial since the proposed tobacco bill collapsed last month in Congress. The state of Florida's class action suit covers 500,000 sick Florida smokers and seeks $200 billion in damages. Tobacco industry lawyers say they plan to repeat arguments that have been successful in past cases. For example, if smokers knew that smoking was risky, they should not hold tobacco companies accountable for the consequences. 30,000 residents of Flagler County, Florida, are on their way home. State officials lifted the evacuation order imposed last week when wildfires threatened much of the county. Kevin Allen of member station WUFT reports from Gainesville.
Even as Governor Lawton Chiles announced residents could return home, he stressed the work was not yet done. At a televised news conference, he said fires still burn in the county, and state officials are still battling them. They're also gearing up to deal with the influx of thousands of people, some of whom may have little to come back to.
We hope to have crisis counselors, other people that can assist them and help them as they are going back into the homes, those that have homes that are destroyed or are damaged.
About 50 homes in Flagler County were destroyed by the fires, which forced residents to spend the 4th of July weekend in hotels and shelters. County officials urged what they called sightseers to stay out until residents could put at least a little of their lives back in order. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Allen in Gainesville.
Militant Protestants in Northern Ireland are still battling with British authorities. Police officers have been attacked, cars stolen, and roads blocked. It began yesterday when soldiers blocked a march by Protestant fraternal group the Orange Order for marching through a Catholic neighborhood. In the ensuing unrest, a policeman suffered a fractured skull. Hundreds of Protestants are now encamped outside a church and plan to stay there until they are allowed to complete their march. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 37 points at 9,062. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, stock market investors seem to be having trouble finding their footing today after the long holiday weekend. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
After a three-day break, Wall Street is having a little bit of a tough time getting motivated again today. Stocks were trending lower shortly after the open, but the market has since rebounded. Number two U.S. car company Ford reports today its overall vehicle sales for June rose a stronger than expected 11%. This week is also the official kickoff of the second half of the year, and that means it's time for companies to report second quarter earnings. Among those firms slated to weigh in this week, General Electric, Motorola, and internet company Yahoo. Johnson & Johnson is leading the Dow lower today. That follows a ratings downgrade from Prudential. Pfizer stock also fell on news two more big healthcare providers, Humana and Prudential, now say they won't pay for the anti-impotence drug Viagra. The companies are citing health and safety concerns. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Upscale fashion retailer Saks Fifth Avenue has been sold to regional department store chain Profit for more than $2 billion. This is another purchase for Profit, which is now the nation's number four department store chain. The chain has done this by buying smaller retailers. Profit says it will change its name to Saks Incorporated, but keep company headquarters in Birmingham, Alabama. Analysts estimate the new firm could garner more than $6 billion this year. Indonesia's new president is asking citizens to fast twice a week to save rice, which is in short supply. President B.J. Habibie made the emergency appeal over the weekend. Indonesia is drawing near to a critical phase of its year-long economic crisis. Relief workers are warning tens of millions of people are falling below the poverty line and cannot afford to eat. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 200 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Yeah, come on.
That's The Doors, one of the great psychedelic bands of the 60s. The mythology surrounding The Doors has mostly centered around its lead singer, Jim Morrison, considered one of rock's tortured poets and sex gods. But instrumentally, The Doors' distinctive sound was based on the keyboard playing of Ray Manzarek. We invited Ray Manzarek to an interview at our piano so he could show us how he came up with some of his now classic organ solos. Manzarek has written a memoir called Light My Fire, My Life with The Doors. The memoir focuses on the years the band performed together, from 1965 through 71, the year of Jim Morrison's mysterious death.
When the music's over, when the music's over, yeah. When the music's over, turn up the lights, turn up the lights, turn up the lights, yeah, yeah.
Ray Manzarek and Jim Morrison attended UCLA film school together, but they didn't think of forming a band until they were both out of school.
Biblically, 40 days and 40 nights after we said our goodbyes after graduation, I'm sitting on the beach wondering what I'm going to do with myself. Who comes walking down the beach but James Douglas Morrison, looking great, lost 30 pounds, was down to about 135, 6 feet tall, Leonardo, Michelangelo's David. He had the ringlets and curly hair starting to kind of fall over his ears and gentle locks. And I thought, God, he looks just great. And I said, Jim, come on over here, man. Come on. It's Ray. Hey, come on. And he said, Ray, oh, man, good to see you. And, you know, we did, hey, buddy, hey, pal, you know, high five and all that kind of stuff that guys do. And I said, well, what have you been up to? He said, well, I decided to stay here in Los Angeles. I said, well, good, man, cool. Tell me, what's going on? And he said, well, I've been living up on Dennis Jacobs' rooftop, consuming a bit of LSD, and writing songs. And I said, whoa, writing songs. Okay, man, cool. Like, sing me a song. You know, and he said, oh, I'm kind of shy. Because I knew he was a poet. He knew I was a musician. He said, sing me a song. So he sat down on the beach, dug his hands into the sand, and the sand started streaming out in little rivulets, and he kind of closed his eyes, and he began to sing in a Chet Baker haunted whisper kind of voice. He began to sing Moonlight Drive, and when I heard that first stanza, let's swim to the moon, let's climb through the tide, penetrate the evening that the city sleeps to hide, I thought, ooh, spooky and cool, man. I can do all kinds of stuff behind that. I could do kind of...
Oh,
sort of like, let's swim to the moon, you know, let's climb through the tide, penetrate the evening that the city sleeps to hide. And I thought, ooh, I can put all jazz chords and I can put some kind of bluesy stuff. I thought, yeah. And I could do my Ray Charles and my and my Muddy Waters, Otis Spann influences, and I could do just all kinds of bluesy, funky stuff behind what Jim was singing. And then he had a couple of other songs, My Eyes Have Seen You and Summer's Almost Gone, and they were just, they had beautiful melodies to them that would just allow for chord changes and improvisations. And I said, man, this is incredible. Let's get a rock and roll band together. And he said, that's exactly what I want to do. And I said, all right, man. But one thing, what do we call the band? It's got no name. We can't call it Morrison and Manzarek. I mean, or Eminem, or, you know, two guys from Venice Beach or something. He said, no, man, we're going to call it The Doors. And I said, that's ridiculous. The Door. Oh, wait a minute. You mean like the doors of perception, the doors in your mind? And the light bulb went on, and I said, that's it, The Doors of Perception. He said, no, just The Doors. I said, like Aldous Huxley. He said, yeah, but we're just The Doors. And that was it. We were The Doors. And that's how the band got formed.
So when you and Jim Morrison decided to create a band that left the lead singer and keyboard player, you still needed other musicians.
Yep.
So you ended up finding the drummer, John Densmore, and guitarist, Robbie Krieger. But you became not only the keyboard player, but the bass player, too.
That was of necessity.
Tell us that story.
We had the four of us. I found John and Robbie in the Maharishi's meditation. And kind of an Eastern mysticism. We were into the same thing, the yoga, same kind of yoga that the Beatles were into. Like, and that came out of the song This Is the End, comes out of that. So we were all seekers after spiritual enlightenment, and so was Jim, of course. But we didn't have a bass player, so I applied my boogie-woogie background, my rock and roll boogie-woogie, because when I discovered boogie-woogie, that was the whole thing. And you just keep that left hand going. You don't do anything with it. It just goes and goes and goes and goes. And the right hand does the improvisations. So I had done that over and over and over as a kid, so it was very easy for me to, once we found the Fender Rhodes keyboard bass, 32 notes of extra low-sounding low notes, it was very easy for me to do. So that's what I did on the piano bass. Or like Riders on the Storm. And that's what I did. I just over and over, repetitive bass lines that are just like Boogie Woogie. It just keeps on going. And it becomes hypnotic. And that was that's why Lefty here is thank you. He did a very good job. He's not too quick. He's a bit of a slow-witted fellow, Lefty, but he's really strong and solid and plays what he has to play. So Lefty became our bass player.
So your left hand and right hand were playing separate keyboards.
Oh, of course, yeah. One was I had a Fender Rhodes the Fender keyboard bass sitting on top of a Vox Continental organ, and the Vox Continental organ was what I played with my right hand, and the Fender keyboard bass with my left hand.
Love me one time, could not speak. Love me one time, baby. Yeah, my knees got weak. Love me two times, girl. Last week, all through the week. Love me two times.
Let me try.
But we'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ray Manzarek, and he's written a new memoir called Light My Fire, and it's about his days with the Doors. In your memoir, you write a lot, about how the Doors developed their sound and how you developed your sound as the keyboard player with the group. Let's take an example of one of those songs. Why don't we look at Light My Fire, which is probably the most famous, or
most
one of
the
famous,
famous Doors song. You know, it's that worldwide popular appeal, most famous. And Robbie Krieger is actually the writer of Light My Fire. So the way we would work on songs is somebody would bring a song in, and then everyone would go to work on it. It'd be like little bees just, or little things spinning and working and weaving. So Robbie came in with a song. He said, "I got a new song called Light My Fire," the first song Robbie Krieger ever wrote. What a genius he is. He's just the greatest guy. Great guitar player and great songwriter. "I've got a song called Light My Fire." So he plays the song for us. And it's kind of a Sonny and Cher kind of dun, 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 light my fire. And it's like, okay, good chord change. What are the chord changes there? And he shows me an A minor to an F sharp minor. And that's like, whoa, that's hip. That's cool. And then... and that's when he went into the Sonny and Cher part. No, we're not going to do a Sonny and Cher kind of song here, man. And that was popular at the time. Densmore says, "Look, we got to do a Latin kind of beat here. Let's do something in kind of a Latin groove." And I'm doing this left hand line. So John's doing ka-ka-chinka, chinka, dunka. And we set up this Latin groove and then go into a hard rock four. And Robbie's only got a one verse. He needs a second verse. And Morrison says, "Okay, let me think about it for a second." And Jim comes up with the classic line, "And our love becomes a funeral pyre. You know that it would be untrue. You know that I would be a liar if I were to say to you, girl, we couldn't get much higher," as Robbie's. Then Jim comes, "The time to hesitate is through." In other words, seize the moment, seize the spiritual LSD moment. "The time to hesitate is through. No time to wallow in the mire. Try now, we can only lose." Whoa, that's kind of heavy. "Try now, we can only lose," meaning the worst thing that can happen to you is death. "And our love becomes a funeral pyre. Our love is consumed in the fires of Agni." And it's like, God, Jim, what a great, great verse, man. So we've got verse, chorus, and then it's time for solo. So anyway, the verse goes, "Time to hit and do that." You know how that goes. You've heard it a million times. And then into the chorus, "Come on, baby, light my fire." So it's time then for some solos. We've done a verse, chorus. Now what do? We got to play some solos. We got to stretch out. Here's where John Coltrane comes in. Here's where the Doors' jazz background. John's a jazz drummer. I'm a jazz piano player. Robbie's a flamenco guitar player. And we all said, you know, we're in A minor. Let's see. What do? It ends up on an E. So how about... My Favorite Things, John Coltrane. It's My Favorite Things, except Coltrane's doing it in D minor. But the left hand is exactly the same thing. It's in 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. A minor, the Doors' Light My Fire is in 4. We're going from A minor to B minor. So it's the same thing as... That's how the solo comes about. And then we just go. So it's John Coltrane's My Favorite Things. And Coltrane's Ole Coltrane. And then that's the chord structure. Then I would solo over it. Robbie would solo over it. And at the end of our two solos, we'd go into a three against four. And I'm keeping the left hand going exactly as it goes. That hasn't changed. That's the four. On top of it is three. Into the turnaround. And we're back at verse one and verse two. And we're back into our Latin groove. So it's basically a jazz structure. It's verse, chorus, state the theme, take a long solo, come back to stating the theme again. And that's how Light My Fire came about. The only thing left to do was to come up with that little turnaround thing. I hadn't had that yet. And we said, now, how do we start the song? Do we just jump on an A minor to an F sharp? We're going to do that, vamp a little bit? I said, no. We need something more. We can't just vamp a little bit. And I started this. I put my Bach back to work, put my Bach hat on, and came up with a circle of fifths. So I started like this. Like a Bach thing, like. So same kind of thing. Yeah. B flat, I'm in G, D, F, up to B flat. E flat, A flat, to the A, to A major, yeah, that's it. And then we'll go to the A minor. I'm thinking all this to myself. So that's how the introduction came about. F, B flat, E flat, A flat, A, and the drums and everything. Jim comes in singing, and a Latinesque. And then into hard rock. So that's how Light My Fire goes. That's the creation of Light My Fire.
And you come up with this great organ solo in the middle.
Oh, that was just luck.
Which is, of course, cut out of the single.
Right, exactly.
Because your producer figured, we got to get this on the radio.
Right.
So we got to do a singles version.
Yeah,
and it was, what, six or seven minute track?
7 minutes. We had to cut down 7 minutes to 2 minutes and under 3 minutes. 2 minutes and 45 seconds, 2:50 would be ideal.
So he calls you into the office, plays you his version,
edited version. Paul Rothschild, a brilliant genius producer, and Bruce Botnick was our engineer. Those two guys were door number five, door number six. Without those two guys, there were six doors in the recording studio, the four musicians and Paul Rothschild and Bruce Botnick. Without them, we never would have done nearly what we did. Paul said, I'm gonna make an edit here. I'm going to do some edits. I'm going to cut Light My Fire down from 7 minutes to 2:45, 2:50. And I said, good luck, man. I don't see how you're going to do it. There's solos, Robbie's solo, my solo, all this stuff. I mean, you're going to have to do little, I figured he's going to have to do little bits and cuts and here and there and there, and just little tiny little incisions, like the Chinese torture of 1,000 cuts is what he was going to have to do. You actually had to cut tape in those days, no computers, so you actually cut the tape. 2 days later, Rothschild calls and said, okay, man, I got it. I said, well, you got it. How did you do it so fast? You got 1,000 cuts. And he said, no. Just come on in. I'm not going to tell you what I did, how I did it. I just want you to listen to it. So the song starts. We're all in the control room on the big speakers at Sunset Sound. The song starts with the regular introduction, and then it's into... And it's going along, and then come on, baby, light my fire, and that's going along. Now we're into the second verse. The time to hesitate is through, no time to wallow in the mire. Try now, we can only lose, our love becomes a funeral pyre. Everything's going exactly, come on, baby, light my fire. Nothing has changed, everything is exactly the same. Come on, baby, light my fire, try to set the night on fire. Now it's time for the solos. I think, where's the edit, man? And we're into the solos. And I thought, I don't know where he's going to cut. This is insane. And all of a sudden, where I'm supposed to go... play my organ solo. What happens? It goes...
It goes to the end of the solos. And it back into the turnaround, and there's like not a solo. There's no solos. I'm out. I've got 3 minutes of solo. Robbie's got 2.5 minutes of solo. It's all gone. It just goes da 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 and turnaround. And I think, oh no, what's and then we go back into verse number 3. And then we do that exactly as the song is. And then verse number 4, it's time to hesitate, no time to wallow in the mire. Trying to be in love becomes a funeral pyre. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire. Try to set the night on fire. Try to set the night on fire. Try to set the night on fire. And it's the end of the song. And that's it. It's 2 minutes and 45 seconds long, and there are no solos in the entire song. And I thought, I'm going to kill this guy. I looked at Robbie, and Robbie said, you want to kill him? Let's kill him. And Paul said, hold it, hold it. Listen, I know the solos aren't there, but just think, you don't know the song. You've never heard the song. You're 17 years old. You're in Poughkeepsie. You're in Des Moines. You're in Missoula, Montana. You've never heard of The Doors. All you know is a 2 minute and 45 second song is going to come on the radio. It's called Light My Fire. Does that work? And we all looked at each other and said, you know what, man? You're right. It does. It works.
Ray Manzarek, he's written a memoir called Light My Fire. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air. Coming up, more with Ray Manzarek about his years with The Doors. Also, the adventure stories of Horatio Hornblower are back in print. Book critic Maureen Corrigan tells us why she's glad they are.
This is the end, beautiful friend. This is the end, my only friend, the end. Of our elaborate plans, the end of everything that stands, the end. No safety or surprise, the end. I'll never look into your eyes again. Can you picture what will be so limitless and free, desperately in need of some stranger's hand in a desperate land?
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Ray Manzarek, the former keyboard player of The Doors. He's written a new memoir called Light My Fire. It's filled with stories about the unpredictable behavior of lead singer Jim Morrison. One of those stories is about what happened during the Light My Fire recording session. The engineer, Bruce Botnick, had brought in a television and put it in the studio, and when Morrison noticed it, he exploded. I'll let Manzarek tell the story.
Bruce Botnick has the Dodgers on. The Dodgers are in the pennant race. Bruce Botnick's a big baseball fan. Sandy Koufax is pitching, the king, the greatest, one of the greatest pitchers of all time. He's recording with the Doors. He brings his portable television set. He wants to see the game. It's the middle of the afternoon. Dodgers are playing, and he's got his television. He couldn't put it in the control room. There's too much electronic equipment, and it just, with the rabbit ears, these are the old days, folks. This is before cable. This is when people had rabbit ears coming off of the television set. He couldn't do it in the control room. Too much electronic equipment, too much static. He found a good place for it off to the side in the studio area, facing the window, the control room window. It wasn't in anybody's way or anything. Everything was fine. So we're in the middle of Light My Fire, and it's solo time. And I'm about to go Coltrane and do my stuff, and Jim comes out of the control room, or out of his vocal booth. You put the singer in a vocal booth. And he starts dancing around. He's having a great time. Then he comes over to the TV set, and he sees the TV set. Then he looks around and notices that it's on. Yo, God, he's... And he freaks out. It's like, what is a TV set on in the recording studio? We're making Doors music here for the first time. This is our first recording session. First time in our lives, we're in the studio. We're doing Light My Fire. And a baseball game is on the TV set. Jim picks up the TV set, unplugs the damn thing, and hurls it at the control room window. We freaked, man. Everybody just, we're in the middle of, I'm just going to town, and all of a sudden it was like, Jim, whoa, no, God, don't throw it at the dwee. Hits the control room window. Thank God the control room window is double thick glass. Bounces off the control room window, falls on the floor, and shatters in 500 pieces. And that was the end of the session. And Bruce Botnick comes running out. He says, Jim, what have you done? And Jim said, what's this TV set doing here, Bruce? I was watching the baseball game. That's my TV set. And Jim said, no TV sets in the recording studio ever.
You also write in your memoir, Light My Fire, about... you know, Jim Morrison's period is like a sexual god. And you write about how, like, he'd wear his leather pants with no underwear so the contours of his manhood can be
yes.
could be seen under the leather. And I'm wondering what it was like for you to kind of be at the epicenter of this kind of like sexual adoration.
Oh, it was fabulous. It was fabulous. I mean, we made our music. That's what we did. You know, the fact that Jim attracted the little girls was something that I knew he was going to do when I saw him at 135 pounds on the beach. We're going to start a rock and roll band, and you're about the handsomest guy I've seen. I didn't say this to him. The girls are going to love this guy. And the girls did love him, of course. I mean, he was just absolutely sexual and absolutely handsome and snaky and, you know, just that kind of guy that girls like. You know, I always wanted girls to like me, but they liked him better. You know, I thought... These glasses. Maybe if I didn't have glasses on, you know, it's like the intellectual kind of. I have to wear glasses. I got bad eyes, you know.
It was funny, you know, in the first Doors publicity photo, which you reprint in the book, Jim Morrison is looking very kind of coy and flirtatious, and you're looking very opaque behind large, large probably sunglasses. Prescription
yeah,
sunglasses.
Prescription sunglasses on top of it, exactly.
One of the really big stories in the lore of the Doors. Is the concert in Miami?
Yes, it is.
Where many people say that Jim Morrison exposed himself.
And, yes, they do.
And you say he didn't exactly, but he had seen the Living Theater a few days before, and that was like the theater group was experimenting with, you know, breaking down the fourth wall and taking off their clothes in the middle of theater performances, confronting the audience, and so on. And he was influenced by that.
Yes, he was.
So,
go ahead.
So, well, what did he say to the audience that got the audience so excited and so expecting him?
Well, what
to
he said,
kind of,
I don't know if I can
himself.
Say that on the radio here.
Well,
my
we'll,
goodness.
We'll do the clean version.
Okay,
of
I'll
what
do the. It's
said.
The C word. He said the C word, ladies and gentlemen. We won't go any further than that. We're in Miami. It's hot and sweaty. It's a Tennessee Williams night. It's a swamp and it's a yuck, horrible kind of place. A seaplane hangar and 14,000 people are packed in there and they're sweaty. And Jim has seen the Living Theater, and he's going to do his version of the Living Theater in front of, this is the first time he's been home. He was born in Melbourne, Florida. This is his, virtually his hometown, and he's going to show these Florida people what psychedelic West Coast shamanism and confrontation is all about. He takes his shirt off in the middle of the set and says, you know, you people haven't come to hear a rock and roll. He's drunk as a skunk, and he didn't tell any of us what he was going to do, if only he'd have told somebody. He said, you didn't come to hear a rock and roll band play some pretty good songs. What you came to see something, didn't you? And they're all going, yeah. He said, what'd you come to see? You came to see something that you've never seen before, something greater than you've ever seen. What do you want? What can I do for you? And the audience is going like this, you know. I'm playing the piano right now inside the strings. That's how the audience is just rumbling and rumbling. And he said, okay, how about if I show you my C word? And all the audience goes screaming crazy. It was like madness. And Jim takes his shirt off, holds it in front of him, reaches behind it, and starts fiddling around down there. And you wonder, what is he doing? And I'm thinking, oh, God, he's going to take it off. And the audience is getting crazier and crazier. And then Jim whips the shirt out to the side. He says, did you see it? Did you see it? Look, I just showed it to you. Watch, I'm going to show you my C word again. I'm going to show it to you. Now keep your eyes on it, folks. And he whips it out. Oh, off to the side again. Off to the side again. Off to the side and says, I showed it to you. You saw it, didn't you? You saw it and you loved it. And you people loved seeing it. Isn't that what you wanted to see? And sure enough, it's what they wanted to see. They hallucinated. I swear the guy never did it. He never whipped it out. It was like in the West Coast, Jesus on a tortilla. It was one of those mass hallucinations. It was, I don't want to say the vision of Lourdes because only Bernadette saw that, but the other people believed and maybe other people said it was one of those kind of religious hallucinations, except it was Dionysus bringing forth, calling forth snakes.
And then you say, he said to the audience, come closer, come on down here.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Get
come on,
with
yeah,
us,
of course,
man.
Sure, come on, join us on stage. And eventually, they started coming on a rickety little stage and the entire stage collapsed, sure.
What were you thinking?
It's chaos. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's rock and roll. It's madness. It's the end of Western civilization. Dionysus has come back from 2,000, 3,000 years ago. He has called forth the snakes. The people have had a mass hallucination. They've rushed the stage trying to get their hands on Dionysus to rip and tear him apart. And I played the riot. John and Robbie left the stage, and I just played screaming, crunching, organ all over the place, just the way I did when my first piano lesson, before the piano lesson, when my mom and dad said, play the piano, and I went... I did the exact same thing on the organ. I was 7 years old going, yeah, and screaming on the organ.
Was there a part of you that was saying, instead of like blah, 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 Dionysus, was there a part of you that was saying, my stupid buddy Jim Morrison is creating this madness. We'll be lucky if we get off the stage alive.
There was a part of me that was saying, we're going to get in big trouble. We're in trouble here. But you know what? It's too late to stop it. So why not treat it as a theatrical event? You know, let's create...
Write a score for it.
Let's make our own reality here. They want theater... Here's some theater you folks never thought you were going to have, but we're going to get in serious trouble. And sure enough, within a week, Jim had been arrested. He had been charged with indecent exposure, public profanity, open profanity, public drunkenness, lewd and lascivious behavior, and this, they read this in court, and simulation of oral copulation. He did take his penis out and shake it. In the courtroom, the audience is going, judge going, order in the court here. And once they read that in court, I knew it was a total fiasco because he had never done it. He didn't do it.
My guest is Ray Manzarek. He's written a memoir called Light My Fire, My Life with the Doors. Let's hear a track from the Doors' second album, Strange Days. This is Moonlight Drive.
The ocean on our
We'll talk more with Ray Manzarek after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ray Manzarek, he's written a memoir called Light My Fire about his years as the Doors keyboard player. Toward the end of the Doors' life as a band, Jim Morrison could only play like about three nights in a row, and he'd just be kind of either spent or just too depressed or manic to one or the other.
No, it wasn't too manic. The manic side, no, it was just, his energy was giving out.
Right.
He was depleting his energy with alcohol. And physically, on the first night he was able to do, he was fine. The second night he was halfway drinking too much. And by the third night, the booze would catch up with him. And he was just kind of hanging on to the microphone. And he had lost his chi, is what he had lost.
He told you he was having a nervous breakdown.
At one point, he said, "I'm having a nervous breakdown." Yeah, exactly. And I thought, "You're not having a nervous breakdown." He said, "I want to quit. I'm having a nervous breakdown." I said, "You can't quit. You're not having a nervous breakdown. You're drinking too much."
When he went to Paris for what you thought would be some rest and relaxation, he ended up dying there.
Yeah.
Mysteriously.
Yes.
At the age of 27.
Yes.
What do you know about his death?
I know what I said in the book. I don't really know anything about it. There's a French doctor's certificate that says his heart stopped, whatever that means. You know, he's not breathing. This corpse is not breathing. Therefore, it is dead. You know, that doesn't say anything. That's insane. People that were there, people that weren't there. Marianne Faithfull was there. The Count, a known heroin addicted Euro trash European guy. Pam was having sort of a quasi affair and needle exchange with the Count. Pam unfortunately eventually did die of a heroin overdose. I don't know that heroin enters into the story of Jim Morrison. It enters into the life of Pamela Curson. A sealed coffin was buried. Our manager went over to see what the story about Jim Morrison being dead was all about, and he arrived in Paris and 3 days later put a sealed coffin into the ground, called me and said, "We buried Jim." And I said, "Oh my God, you buried him? You mean those rumors and those stories, that story about Jim being dead, that's true?" He said, "Yeah, it wasn't a story, man. I put the coffin, and Pam was there, and two of his French friends were there, and Alain and Agnes Varda, and we buried Jim in Père Lachaise Cemetery." Well, he couldn't pronounce the name. In a French cemetery, I don't know what the name of the place is, Ray. And I said, "Well, how did he look?" He said, I don't know. I said, "What do you mean you don't know?" He said, "I never saw the body."
You don't believe it wasn't him, though, do you?
I don't know what I believe, you know? I believe Jim Morrison's dead. I haven't heard from him in 27 years now. I assume he's dead, you know? I mean, as far as I'm concerned, he's dead. But there's a lot of stories. How did he die? See, how did he die? We don't know. And quite frankly, I don't care how he died. If he's dead, he's dead. God rest his soul. However, Dionysus rises again. Dionysus is the god of rising, of resurrection, as is Osiris, the Egyptian god, as is Jesus the Christ, the god of resurrection for Christians. Jim Morrison is also going to rise again on July 6th, the year 2001. They're digging up his grave, and they're throwing him out of the cemetery. The lease is up, a 30-year lease, and they're not going to renew the lease. This is what I've heard. They're not going to renew the lease on Jim Morrison's grave, and his remains are going to have to be removed from Père Lachaise Cemetery.
Wow. Where is he going to go?
It doesn't matter. How disgusting.
It's an awful,
terrible thought. You know, what are they going to do? They'll throw him in a pauper's grave or something, like Mozart, you know?
Are they not renewing because there's so many people who come there
exactly.
to make the pilgrimage?
Exactly. It's a riot going on there. Yeah.
So did you have to reinvent yourself after Jim Morrison died and that was the end of the Doors?
No, I just had to get on to the next thing. I'm the same person I was before. You know, my psychedelic and cosmic vision formed when I was 25.
is the exact same one I have today. What I'd be telling you, what I'm telling you today, is what I would have told you 2 weeks after Jim Morrison died. I'm the exact same person. You know, once you open the doors of perception, I mean, Ray, do you still take acid? No, I don't take acid. Do you still get high anymore? You don't need to. Once you open the doors of perception, the doors of perception are cleansed. They stay cleansed. They stay open, and you see life as in an infinite voyage of joy and adventure and strangeness and darkness and wildness and craziness and softness and beauty. So that's how I live my life, and I haven't changed. I didn't really have to reinvent myself. It took a long time to get over Jim's death, however. You know, that was a real sad, that was a sad, sad period for me.
I want to end with something that you've just done that's very connected to everything we've been talking about, which is that you produced a track by the band X.
Yes, exactly.
For the X-Files movie.
For the X-Files movie. Mm-hmm.
And the song is Crystal Ship.
Crystal Ship, a Doors song.
Yeah. So before we hear this new version, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the original version.
The original version of Crystal Ship contained a forbidden B-flat major. You don't put a major chord into rock and roll. Rock and roll is minor, and rock and roll is, you know, just straight ahead sevenths or a minor seventh. You can do that, or you can do just straight ahead. But you don't put in a major seventh. It's a modern jazzy kind of chord, and it's like the difference between two generations. So I put it into Crystal Ship before you slip into unconsciousness. I'd like to have another kiss. Another flashing chance at bliss, another kiss. And that B-flat major seventh just caused me more anguish at the Whiskey a Go-Go. It's just, all the hippies just hated that. It's like, that's a corny old chord, Ray. Don't put that chord in a Doors song. And I said, no, you don't understand, man. It's a cool jazz chord. So, why don't we listen to X's version of the Crystal Ship and see what a punk rock band does to the Crystal Ship.
And do you play on this?
Yes, I do. I'm tweaking a little bit of organ. You'll hear a little bit of organ up at the top of it, and I play along with my good friends John Doe and Xene and Don Bonebreak and Billy Zoom, America's greatest rock and roll band, punk rock rock and roll band.
Ray Manzarek, it's been great to have you here. Thank you so much.
It's been good to be here.
And Ray Manzarek's new memoir is called Light My Fire, My Life with the Doors. And here's the record he produced by X of Crystal Ship for the X-Files movie.
Before you slip into unconsciousness, I'd like to have another kiss, another flashing. Filled with pain, and close me in your gentle.
Tomorrow we'll talk with Jack Holtzman about his adventures with the Doors. Holtzman founded Elektra Records, the Doors record company. Coming up, our book critic Maureen Corrigan catches up on some classic adventure stories. This is Fresh Air. At the 1980 Democratic National Convention, Jimmy Carter committed a famous gaffe when he referred to Hubert Humphrey as Hubert Horatio Hornblower. If nothing else, that slip of the tongue attested to the enduring popularity of Horatio Hornblower, hero of a series of books by C.S. Forrester. The Hornblower books are being republished, and a new series of Hornblower movies is being made for television. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan is ready to sign on for these and future Hornblower voyages.
C.S. Forrester wrote his first Horatio Hornblower novel in 1937. At his death in 1966, he was hard at work on his 12th. By then, the Hornblower series had attained the status of a modern classic, lauded by the likes of Ernest Hemingway and Winston Churchill. But if the Hornblower books had never exactly sunk into obscurity, they have, over the years, become barnacled over with a crust of quaintness. Hornblower, no less than Tarzan or James Bond, is a man of action who espouses old-fashioned values like honor and duty. To polish up the series and to cash in on the current vogue for sea stories like Patrick O'Brien's novels and Sebastian Younger's A Perfect Storm, Little Brown Publishers has just brought out a new hardcover edition of Mr. Midshipman Hornblower, which is chronologically the first Hornblower story. Trade paperbacks of two more Hornblower novels will appear in the fall. I say, bring on the fleet. As a landlubber who doesn't know a jib from a mizzenmast, I'd always bypass the Hornblower series, thinking it too swashbuckling, too ahoy-me-hearties for my taste. Not true. If the rest of the books are anything like Mr. Midshipman Hornblower, then they're a salty treat for the mind as well as the imagination. I don't know when, in the history of aesthetics, adventure tales became classified as second-rate literature. Somehow I suspect that those champion wool-gatherers, Henry James and Virginia Woolf, are to blame. But the Hornblower series reminds us, oh too sophisticated readers, that a great adventure story can be as breathtaking a work of art as any stream of consciousness rumination. When Mr. Midshipman Hornblower opens, the skinny, seasick, 17-year-old Horatio Hornblower is wobbling his way aboard his first ship. It's the era of the Napoleonic Wars, roughly the same time period covered in Jane Austen's novels. While Austen's young women struggle to stay afloat in the marriage market, Hornblower struggles to stay afloat in the Royal Navy. Each chapter in Mr. Midshipman Hornblower constitutes a discreet escapade. Hornblower, by turns, encounters the dangers of spark-throwing Spanish fireships, the Black Plague, and sadistic officers. Like Sherlock Holmes, Hornblower boasts a mathematical mind, and it's a pleasure to watch him, over and over again, frantically calculate a course of action that will veer him out of the path of certain death. C.S. Forrester was a champ at writing action scenes that give readers enough nautical detail to heighten our awareness of just how much peril Hornblower is in. Here's a passage from Mr. Midshipman Hornblower in which our hero, who's terrified of heights, must scale the rigging of an enemy ship by night in order to disable its sails. He hauled himself onto the topmast shrouds and began the final ascent, his lungs bursting with the effort. Here was the topsail yard, and Hornblower flung himself across it and felt with his feet for the foot rope. Merciful God, there was no foot rope. His feet, searching in the darkness, met only unresisting air. 100 feet above the deck he hung, squirming and kicking like a baby, held at arm's length in his father's hands. There was no foot rope, so that he could not make his way out to the yardarm. Yet the gaskets must be cast off and the sail loosed. Everything depended on that. Hornblower had seen daredevil seamen run out along the yards, standing upright, as though walking a tightrope. That was the only way to reach the yardarm now. Perhaps the thing that surprised me most as a first-time Hornblower reader is the current of melancholy that runs through these tales. Forster describes the monotonous misery of life at sea, the months of wet weather and salt pork rations. We're also made to realize how expendable most of the seamen are, including Hornblower. Of course, he does survive, eventually attaining the rank of admiral. Here, at the very beginning of his career, the ship Hornblower serves on is called the Indefatigable. I have a feeling that's also the perfect word to describe the entire Hornblower series.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.